Your gender is not supposed to make a difference in your ability to do a job. That's the theory now. But for much of recorded history, there were many jobs women were not supposed to do. Bad for the organs, or their brains couldn't handle the work. There have been all kinds of excuses. As a result, some geniuses who did not have penises did not get the recognition they deserved and often got a lot worse. Janice Kaplan examines women past and present in her book, The Genius of Women, From Overlooked to Changing the World. Janice Kaplan has been a journalist for a long time in several different news media. She was the editor-in-chief of Parade magazine and has been a television producer as well. Janice is author or co-author of 14 previous books, including The Gratitude Diaries. Janice Kaplan, thanks for joining us today.
Well, my pleasure to be here. Thank you. Today is publication day, so it's exciting to get to talk about the genius of women.
Oh, good. I didn't realize we got you right on the date. That's excellent. Good. Good to have you here. The book begins with poll results. I mean, how many people still think geniuses tend to be men?
Right. Wasn't that surprising? A friend of mine who's a pollster came to me with that survey that he had done where he found that 90% of Americans say that geniuses tend to be men. You can't get 90% of Americans to agree on anything. And he was pretty much taken aback by that. And when asked to name a female genius, virtually the only one anybody came up with was Marie Curie. And so we had lunch one day. He presented those poll findings to me. He said, "What do you think is going on?" I didn't have an answer for him, but I spent the next 2 years trying to come up with one.
So that was indeed the spark that got this book going?
It sure was. And as you said earlier, I thought, you know, we tell girls that they can do anything, but does that mean anything but being a genius? And I've always been interested in women's issues. I've written about them in many different ways over the years. And this just seemed like a great way to focus it and find a way to look at a very broad issue by focusing it slightly differently.
And you include some of your own experiences in here. And I think I put about 9 H's in. Oh, my God. You were how old when your family doctor told your mom that you read too much?
Right. I was 9 years old, and I always thought it was a great thing that I read too much or read a lot, and I was a smart kid in school. And the family doctor told my mom that, as you said, I was reading too much, and she worried, and she said, "Oh, does that mean there's something wrong with her eyes?" And he said, "No, no, no, her eyes are fine." But then in a dire tone, he said, "But, you know, a girl can be too smart for her own good." And my mom seemed to completely understand what he was saying, but I did not. I actually thought being smart was supposed to be a good thing. And yet comments like that linger in the back of your mind for a very long time and have an influence on you. I think we're wise enough that we don't say something directly like that to little girls anymore, but we probably send them that message in a lot more ways than we realize.
That's an interesting thought, though, that we may stop saying those things, but not believing them takes a bit longer.
Right. I spoke to one woman for the book named Cynthia Brazil, and she's a roboticist at the MIT Media Lab. And she's a very cool woman. She created the first social robot that's now actually at the MIT Museum. And she has 2 teenage sons. And she told me that when she watches her sons with their friends who are both boys and girls, she realizes that we live in an age of 1,000 nudges, that we're always pushing girls in a slightly different direction than boys. When they're very little, we tell boys, we put boys in astronaut costumes on Halloween, and we put girls in princess costumes. And then they get a little bit bigger, and a girl comes home from school and says, "I'm having trouble in math." And mom says, "Don't worry, dear, you're doing so well in drama." A boy comes home and says he's not doing well in math. You get him a tutor and make sure he is doing well in math. So it's just those little nudges that we're sometimes not aware of, but that do affect us in the long run.
Another story that you tell here about your own life is you spent some time at Oxford University, which I didn't realize started admitting women in 1879, but didn't give them degrees until decades later. You had an Oxford professor, though, Susan Wallenberg, and she discovered some interesting things about women composers.
Right. Well, she was, I believe, the first woman to be a professor of music at Oxford. And she had been an undergraduate at Oxford. And she was surprised to realize that she never studied any women, that the music she played was by men and the people she studied were men. And she thought there must have been women sometime because women always loved playing music. And so she has been one of the people, and there are several professors, who have been rediscovering some of these great women composers from the past and bringing their music to attention, because work needs to be recognized in order for us to recognize that the person behind it did have talent.
But there we go with women composers, and you do get readers to think about how often we say woman scientist, woman artist, etc. still.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's a great danger that we do that because we tend to lump people together that way. I interviewed the Broadway director, Tina Landau, who's a wonderful and creative director. And she said she doesn't like to be referred to as a woman director. She thinks of herself as a woman who directs. And there's a big distinction between those two phrases. Woman director says that all women must direct in the same way, and that being a woman director describes what your style is. A woman who directs says you're a woman, but you're a director. And those are distinct activities. And it's so important for us to look at it that way. There was an exhibit at the Barnes Foundation, which I mentioned, which featured the wonderful Impressionist painter Berta Morisot. And good for the Barnes Foundation to have done a solo show of her work. But they titled the show Berta Morisot, Woman Impressionist. Could you imagine a show called Claude Monet, Male Impressionist? You just wouldn't do it. So we still have men as the default, and when we mention that it's a woman, we make sure that we say it is, because somehow that seems different.
That is such a sticky binary, as you demonstrate in the book over and over, that it's genius or woman genius.
Right, and I think that genius is actually field-specific, not gender-specific. The women scientists who I interviewed had a lot in common with the male scientists and far less in common with the women artists. And so to lump people together, to assume that 50% of the population all have the same traits, is just a big mistake. And I think we do that sometimes, even trying to do it with a positive spin. So you hear often now that women are collegial and collaborative, and that's sometimes used as an explanation for why they should be on corporate boards and in companies and perhaps even in the White House, that they don't seek the spotlight, that they like to work with other people. Well, that's just silly, isn't it? I mean, some women are collegial and cooperative, some women are great leaders, some men are collegial and cooperative, and some men are great leaders. And once we start assuming that those stereotypes are right, we start looking for the people who fill them. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that women start behaving in the ways they're expected to, and men start behaving in the ways that they're expected to.
Okay, moving away from pigeonholing is our task then. The book is called The Genius of Women. Janice Kaplan, the author. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Janice Kaplan, the longtime journalist, is our guest on the Exchange, writing another book. She's written more than a dozen already. This one is about women and genius and how often you have to say woman genius, because 90% of the American public apparently thinks that genius applies to men generally. This book is called The Genius of Women, From Overlooked to Changing the World. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about people in many fields. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. And as I was just saying, many fields. So we have, we just mentioned a roboticist, a theater director, a painter. So this genius, as you're pointing out, just go, you go across many realms here.
Absolutely. And I look at just people who are doing extraordinary work in different ways. And it was fun to do that and to collect so many different stories, both in the present and historically.
Well, it's an interesting point that a British friend of yours mentions in the book about ability and celebrity and how those have to come together for people to be considered geniuses.
Right. I was in London and I met a professor named Charles Jones, who was a professor at Cambridge. And when I told him that I was working on genius, he sort of thought about it for a moment. And in his very plumy English accent, which I won't try to imitate, he said, genius, that would be where extraordinary talent meets celebrity. And I was sort of taken aback by that, because he is a serious academic. He did not mean celebrity in any Kardashian sort of way. I'm sure he has never watched reality TV. But I quickly understood that what he meant was just getting your work noticed. And whether you're in academia, in a corporation, in sciences or the arts, a lot of people do great work, but a lot of that work gets ignored. And for so much of history, and even often right up to this very moment, women have had only one half of that equation. They've had the extraordinary talent, but they haven't had the celebrity. They haven't had their work being noticed. And that has been a serious problem that hopefully we will start to overcome.
Which really sets the mind a spinning, because if women geniuses were so rare, it seems like they might have been celebrated more or maybe even encouraged.
Well, I think we just didn't notice them. There were throughout history women doing great things, but let me give you an example. There was a physicist in the 1930s named Lise Meitner who discovered nuclear fission. And nuclear fission is kind of a big deal. It's what has led to nuclear energy and, alas, nuclear weapons. It turned physics on its head when she made that breakthrough, and it went ahead and won the Nobel Prize. I say it won the Nobel Prize because Lise Meitner did not. Her lab partner, Otto Hahn, did. Otto Hahn, from what I understand, was a very nice man and a very good chemist. But even Lise Meitner at the time said he didn't really understand all that much about nuclear fission. But as it happened, the men, and of course they were men, on the Nobel Committee just couldn't even imagine that a woman could have made that breakthrough. Their minds just couldn't even take that in. So they just assumed that it had to have been her lab partner. It had to have been Otto Hahn who did the great work, with the woman perhaps supporting him.
And in case anybody thinks that Lise Meitner was being snippy or something, the fact is that Otto Hahn himself said in his own works that he wasn't quite sure what she was up to.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they remained great friends for their whole lives. But when the findings or the deliberations of the Nobel Committee were released many years later, as they are, some physicists looked at it and called it one of the most egregious oversights ever. And that's saying a lot, given how many people have been overlooked.
We should point out, too, that Lise Meitner had to do her work in some substandard conditions. I mean, where was she forced to work, for example, at the University of Berlin?
Well, that's right. She was at the University of Berlin. She had left Vienna because, first of all, when she was growing up, women weren't even allowed in school. She had to be privately educated until the universities finally started accepting women when she was in her 20s, and then she went on and got a PhD. She then did go to Berlin. She became a full professor, the first woman to be so, but she was shunted off into a little lab basement where the bathroom was in the next building. So she had the title, but she still was not treated with any sort of respect or dignity. And, you know, women had a lot to overcome, and that she continued to do her work and to ignore all of that and to succeed in the way she did is really quite extraordinary.
Lise Meitner's face is what graces the web blurb about this particular interview on our website at jeffexchange.org. We're talking to Janice Kaplan about her new book, The Genius of Women, From Overlooked to Changing the World. Let's go further back in time. Hypatia, who was she?
She was one of the first great mathematicians, her work was often attributed to her father, because nobody really wanted to think that in those days a woman could have done such things. She had a very tragic end where she was killed, and she has become in some ways a great model of women succeeding early on. Her dramatic killing perhaps makes her less something we would all like to emulate.
Was she killed because she was so intelligent?
You know, it's a little hard to know. It was a long, long time ago, and there were many issues there, but it certainly didn't help.
Let's talk about other bad reactions to women's genius. Charlotte Bronte sent a writing sample to England's poet laureate, and he had a not particularly great reply.
Right. He told her that women really should not be writing, and that her work would never be any good, and she should give it up. And she did not. And I tell the story about being in Westminster Abbey at the Poets' Corner, where both of them have statues now, and they sort of overlook each other. And I think it's a lovely tribute to the women who were able to go on despite the people trying to stop them. But by the way, Charlotte Bronte and her sisters, Charlotte Bronte, of course, wrote Jane Eyre, but she and her sisters published their first works under men's names, because they didn't think that anybody would pay attention to them or that their work would be treated seriously if they were published under their own names. And one other Charlotte Bronte story, since you mentioned her, the New York Times has recently started a column called Overlooked, because they realized that 90% of the obituaries that they have written over the years were of men. And they realized that they overlooked an awful lot of women. And in the very first piece of that column that they did, they chose five women to highlight, and one of them was Charlotte Bronte. And you look back and you think, what was the New York Times thinking back in those days that Charlotte Bronte wasn't even considered worthy of an obituary? And it does remind you just how specific to the time and the context the people that we admire and recognize are, and how little it has to do with the work they do. Jane Eyre has not changed in all this time. The book is the same, but what we think of it, what the tastemakers tell us we should think of it, is what has changed.
Well, that's the second 90% mind blow of this interview. The first one, of course, was that 90% of Americans think men are the only geniuses. Wow. So let's talk. We were talking about women composers earlier, about Susan Wallenberg, one of your professors at Oxford. So let's go to a woman composer and musician, Mozart's sister, Maria Anna, who he called Non-Earl in his many, many letters. She had a huge talent, but what happened to it?
Right. Well, she was Wolfgang's older sister, and like him, she was a child prodigy, and she was quite a brilliant musician. When she was quite young, the two of them toured together, and apparently she got great raves and was often considered the better musician than he was. But when she became an early teenager, her father told her it was time to go home, to stop playing her music, and to just get married. And can you imagine? Can you imagine telling a man that he has to give up what he loves to go home and get married? He would say, why can't I do both? But it's really hard to stand up to a whole society that's sending you a message, and she did go home. Her talent was not nurtured any further than that, and we have forgotten her. I often think, you know, if Mozart had been in that position and he only got to play his music at home, Mozart wouldn't be Mozart. If Beethoven was not allowed to play outside of his living room, we probably wouldn't have heard of him either. And the stories like Mozart's sister just kind of break your heart. And beyond that, you realize all of the women who never had any chance, whose names we just completely don't know because the expectations for them were so limited from the very first.
Now, at this point, all we can hope for is letters in an attic someplace in a trunk that will reveal the genius of somebody that we've forgotten about.
Right.
Janice Kaplan is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called The Genius of Women, From Overlooked to Changing the World. It's a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe propose some geniuses that you would like to bring to our attention as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dale in Ashland sent in an email. He says, I am a male and had a career as a registered nurse. I loathed being called a male nurse. Good grief. Just call me an RN. Cheers from Dale.
Yeah, great point. Great point. That's the opposite side of the same problem, right? Nurses are supposed to be women, so a man must be different, and we point out that difference. And good for him, good for Dale for being a nurse and for recognizing that problem. We need to fight it on both sides of the aisle, both sides of the gender equation.
Indeed, we do. Thanks for that note, Dale. I did. You know, speaking of societal attitudes and at least in some places they've changed, but I didn't realize that Saudi Arabia was using the old Western excuse for women not driving. The one about, was it organs?
Right, that that I believe it would somehow prevent women from conceiving and from having children. And over again, we just hear these absolutely ridiculous stories of why women can't do something. And often it's in the guise of men protecting women. And I have learned to be very, very wary of men protecting women, because usually what they're protecting is their own interests, their own power, and their own needs, and wanting to control, not protect. So yes, we can laugh at the story that if you drive, it's going to somehow crush your organs and you're not going to be able to have a baby, but that's happening right now. It's happening right now in this world, and similar stories are told to all of us, even in this country, too.
Well, which should confirm that sexism, like racism, includes lots of pseudoscience, which I had written that question, and then I turned a couple pages, and hey, there was Francis Galton, the father of eugenics, so yeah, here we are.
Right, exactly. And so many of the ways that we've always had of measuring genius or measuring intelligence turn out to be completely specious, to have no basis in science or fact, whether it was wrapping a tape measure around your head to see who had the largest head, or even right up to our own IQ tests, which are shown over and over again to have so little bearing on people's talents, abilities, and how they ultimately function. And yet we still hold on to them, even though they actually, all they seem to actually show is how good people are at taking IQ tests. And so many of those ways of determining who is a genius or who is intelligent are based on who already is. So it's the people in power conferring more power on those who are like them, and to say, oh, look, you've achieved that, then that must be for this reason. So I think we need to put so many of those, as you said, that pseudoscience aside and look at things from a more rational perspective.
Now, obviously, not all the women you write about in the book went quietly. You talk about Madame de Stael in France two-plus centuries ago. She wasn't having it. What did she do about organizing the great minds of her time?
I love Madame de Stael. She was at the time of the French Revolution, and because women were not allowed to be educated at the time, she was a well-to-do woman, and she had salons in her own home where people came, and some of the great minds of the time gathered and talked, and she became a great powerhouse, an incredibly smart woman, and she is often referred to as one of the great banes of Napoleon, because she stood up against Napoleon. He banned her from the country. She started salons where she had been in exile. And so, yes, she was proof that a woman of fire and fury can find her way around the social obstacles, no matter how difficult they are.
All right, which brings us back to modern times once again, though, and the fact that that even though we've had people fighting clearly for centuries upon centuries to get some level of equality for women's brains, we have the situation where you have the Genius Bar in the Apple stores and the Butterball Turkey Hotline. And who do they expect to staff those?
Right. And, you know, I spoke to one of the women who was at the Genius Bar at the Apple Store. By the way, a very cleverly named place to have tech people, because when your computer is not working or your phone goes on the fritz, don't you want a genius to be able to fix it for you? But she said that she often finds that people come to the Genius Bar, a woman is helping them, and they just immediately doubt her. And now, though they're called geniuses, they all basically have the same sheet of information of what they do and the rules that they follow to figure out what's wrong with something. But often, she said, people would ask for one of her male colleagues to come over, and they would repeat the problem. Invariably, the guy who came over would give the exact same solution or advice that she did, but then the customer tended to be much more satisfied because the guy had said it. And, you know, how silly is that? And yet it's something that that happens over and over today.
Let's talk about somebody else in contemporary times, Jo Dunkley at Princeton University. What has she been doing?
Jo Dunkley is a tenured professor of physics at Princeton and has done some extraordinary work. She's quite young. She's won some wonderful awards, and she had been at Oxford before. And I was so intrigued by Professor Dunkley, because she told me that when she was rising up at Oxford, she just didn't see bias at all. She would see that there were signs for women in physics meetings, and she never went to them because she didn't see herself as a woman in physics, as we were discussing before. She saw herself as a physicist. And because it didn't occur to her that she was the only woman in her physics classes, often she didn't worry about raising her hand and asking questions. And she went on to achieve and to be a huge success. And so I said to her, well, if you were able to do it, doesn't that suggest that all women should be able to do it? And she was quick to stop me and to say, no, you shouldn't have to have my personality in order to achieve. And you shouldn't have to have that you know, core and strength and confidence that she has in order to be a woman who can succeed in physics. And so she has now gone on, now that she is in the position where she's a tenured professor and she's a very top level, she has now gone on to be a huge supporter of women. And now she not only goes to the Women in Physics conferences, she runs the Women in Physics conferences. And it was a pleasure for me to see that in Jo Dunkley and in so many other women, that they did ignore obstacles on their way up. But once they got to the top, they worked really hard to push those obstacles away for other women.
But, you know, it's easy to see her point. It's like, it shouldn't have to be somebody as forceful as me, because you don't have to be as forceful as me and be a man to make great gains in some of the, particularly in the scientific professions.
Right. And, you know, we don't ask, it's the same with Mozart's sister. We don't ask men to stand up to all of society in order to achieve. We just ask them to go ahead and do their work. And for a male physicist, we just ask him to go ahead and do his work. And now Jo Dunkley and her counterpart at Yale is a woman named Meg Urey. Meg's a little older than Jo Dunkley. And she was the first woman to be a tenured professor of physics at Yale. And she also headed the Yale physics department. And she said that when she was young, she would look at women. She worked at NASA for a long time, and she would look for women role models, and she didn't have any. There were just no women doing what she wanted to do. And so she told herself, oh, it must be because there are no women who ever wanted to do this before. And that's how she convinced herself that it was okay to keep going. And of course, she said now that she looks back, she realizes, in her words, that's total baloney. Of course, there were other women who wanted to do this, but they just had too many challenges in their path. And Meg is also a huge advocate now for women and a huge advocate for getting rid of some of those challenges and obstacles and opening the door and being.
Apologies, the break nailed the last couple of words, I think, of what you were saying there. But we were talking about women who have tried to provide pathways for the women who come behind them. But the interesting section of this portion of the book is where you talk to Shirley Tilghman, former Princeton president, now teaching science again, who referred to the treatment of some women in academic settings today as poodles. What does she mean by that?
Well, Shirley was the president of Princeton, the first woman president. There we go again with the first women. And she was also a molecular biologist. And she, I guess she's probably in her late 60s or so, and she said that women of her generation went out with force and fury to try to change the world. And they knew that there were going to be problems and obstacles in their path, and they didn't mind pushing forward. And she worries very much about young women now who see themselves as victims and who look at the societal structures and the problems and just see themselves as victims rather than as feeling like I can go out and fight this and do whatever I want. And yes, she said she sometimes thinks that we've started to coddle young women too much, and she did say that sometimes she thinks the women that undergraduates at Princeton are now treated like poodles, and maybe that's not a good thing when they go out into the real world and find out that not everyone is going to be as kind as perhaps the university setting will be.
Which raises some interesting questions, like, does this mean the university should be really hard on them or something so they'll know what the world is like outside? Because I know people have been brought up in those environments or taught in those environments. It's like, well, it's going to be a lot tougher out there, and it wasn't it particularly pleasant.
Right. Well, I think the idea is much more just to try to, again, as we were saying before, see men and women in the same way. Shirley Tilghman said that when she was younger, she used to close her eyes and try to picture a scientist. And when she could picture a woman as often as she pictured a man, she knew she was okay. And because she had that and because she had done that so ardently for herself, when she did go on to become the president of Princeton, she put a lot of women in very high positions of power and importance at the university. And shockingly, much of the student body rebelled against that and said, oh, they must not be as qualified as the men. And she was just shocked. She was just shocked that in this time the young women would feel that and would not rebel against anybody saying that. And by the way, at least three or four of the people that she had selected have now gone on to be university presidents themselves. So let's just say that the people she selected were not too too shoddy.
I guess not. We have a couple of emails here. Becca in Lane County writes, I'm 70. We've been discussing these gender issues my whole life. Can this problem ever be solved? And then Larry Cooper asks a similar question. We're seeing very bright, capable women being dismissed in our presidential race. What's going on? Some thoughts on those?
Yeah, I think the presidential race is a conundrum. It's always hard to separate out what is gender and what is actual issues. But I think we hear so often the refrain of, can a woman be elected? And once you put that out there, then you're basically saying no. You're basically saying, this is a danger. Do we want to face this? And I don't think the United States realizes how incredibly backwards we are in the world in not ever having had a woman president, a woman leader. And I tell the story in the book of having encountered a particularly difficult man at some dinner party I was at who was blathering on about men. And I asked him how many women leaders he thought there had been. And I think he came up with, 5 or 10. And it turns out there have been more than 60 countries that have had women leaders. And there's a whole raft of them that have women leaders right now. So that America is still asking that question, still asking, can a woman be the president, is just stunningly backwards. And how we get over that, I don't know. But it certainly is having a big effect on the current elections.
And it's interesting, too, because I noticed that even women writers like Froma Harrop referred to Elizabeth Warren as grating a few weeks ago. And I don't know if she's ever used that term on a man.
Right. Well, there's a professor at Cambridge named Mary Beard who has written a wonderful book called Women in Power. It's a very little, slight book. And she talks about that whole idea of women's voices and how it is that we have decided that women's voices don't sound as powerful as men's voices. And some of the gendered language that we use. We talk about women whining when we would never say a man is whining. What does that mean? It's just a way of being dismissive, and it's a way of putting people down. And I don't find Elizabeth Warren grating at all. I think she gives a wonderful presentation. Whether you like her ideas or not is a different matter, but let's not get caught in that.
Yeah, whining, grating, shrill. I've heard a lot of the terms thrown at women politicians you never hear used on men.
Exactly.
Let's see. We have an email, phone call here from Dick in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Janice Kaplan, the author of The Genius of Women.
Thank you. I just wanted to give a shout-out to Maureen Phillips, who's a very accomplished pianist here in Southern Oregon, and she has focused a lot on Fanny Mendelssohn, recording her own piano playing of Fanny Mendelssohn's compositions, and that's Felix Mendelssohn's wife, or Felix Mendelssohn is her husband.
But the sister.
Yeah, was it his sister?
Sister, yeah.
Sister, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, anyway, Maureen suggests that at least some of Felix Mendelssohn's compositions are actually Fanny's.
All right. Thanks for that, Dick. Appreciate it. And yeah, Fanny Mendelssohn became Fanny Hensel when she married, but definitely Felix's sister, but quite accomplished in her own right.
Well, that's actually, it's a great, I'm so glad that that he brought that story up because it's a wonderful, or sad, story. Fanny Mendelssohn, much like Mozart's sister, was a terrific composer and musician, and again, probably better than her brother. And in the early days, she really led her brother, and she did some extraordinary presentations and concerts when she was 12 that got the international praise even at the time. And then when she was 14, her father, Abraham Mendelssohn, sent her a letter telling her that, as with Mozart's sister, it was time to go home and get married. And he said that for Felix, music could always be his career, but for her, it could never be the root of her being. Well, you know, it was the root of her being, but she was clever enough to go home, to get married. She continued playing music by doing salons in her own home, and she continued composing, and your caller is absolutely right. She published a lot of her work under the name of her brother, Felix. who said that he was doing it as a great favor to her. My favorite story is that Felix did pretty well by this also. He got invited to Buckingham Palace once, and Queen Victoria told him how much she loved one of his songs. It was her favorite song ever. What could the man say? He knew that Fanny had written it.
She 460 pieces of music I'm reading off of Wikipedia, and she only lived to be not quite 42.
At the very end of her life, she did publish a few pieces under her own name. She said that she was tired of all this hiding. And guess what? The world did not fall apart when Fanny Mendelssohn admitted that it was her work. And she said it was the most joyous time of her life to get that acclaim. And sadly, she died very shortly afterwards.
Let's stick in the art world and tell us about the Guerrilla Girls.
The Guerrilla Girls, it was an organization of women artists who were trying to point out just how badly women artists are treated. And they wear masks so that they're not seen as who they are. And they wear gorilla masks, and they take the names of some of the great artists of the past. And they were the ones who had posters that pointed out things like how few women there are in museums represented on the walls. I think they had one poster that said, "You're more likely to get into a museum by being naked and having a man paint you than to actually be the painter." And they've made a big difference. In the early days of their activism, they were dismissed, and now their work is hanging in some of the museums around the world. So it's fun to see that, and fun to see how the points that they were making early on, for which they were dismissed, have now become salient to the rest of us. One other quick comment on them is that I was so interested because many of the critics early on complained that, well, these Guerrilla Girls were just women who were bad artists themselves. So, of course, they were protesting, and of course, that's why their work wasn't in the museums. May I remind you, they were wearing masks and using fake names. Nobody knew who they were. So how could these critics have been complaining that the problem was that they were bad artists? It just shows how deeply ingrained our biases are that, once again, we didn't bother to let facts get in the way.
And speaking of deeply ingrained biases, we have another email here from John and Eugene who writes, "My wife and I were in graduate school at Princeton in 1982. While there, we met the first woman admitted to the doctoral program in mathematics. And my wife, who was in the PhD program in art history, was told by her advisor that there is no place for women at Princeton. Just important to know that we are far from overcoming the issues your guest is raising," writes John and Eugene.
Wow, that's a great story. And that's not very long ago, is it? 1982. And that kept striking me over and over again, how recent some of these stories are. And, you know, we're probably going to be telling the stories of what's happening today in 10 years in a similar way that he is.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though, that the cultural part of this, because you point out the Italian paradox in math. What is that about?
That was a woman named Carla Maltini, who I met at the University of London, who was a mathematician and physicist there. And she was Italian. And she was from a very small town in Italy. And it was a very conservative town where most of the women did not even go on to college. And I said to her, "Well, how did you possibly then learn math and have the courage to do math?" And she said, "Oh, well, in my town, it's just expected that women do math. That's not considered a problem. Women are considered to be better than men in math." And she said that in the southern Mediterranean, that's often the case. And she pointed out that all of her colleagues who were professors in physics who were women were all from the southern Mediterranean countries. And so it's quite striking that these stereotypes exist so deeply and have such an impact on us. And most women who aren't good in math will think, "Oh, it's not that I'm, it's because I'm a woman and it has nothing to do with where I grew up." But just think about it. You know, if you grew up in southern Italy, you'd probably have a good pasta recipe and you might be able to talk with your hands. And there's also a good chance that having grown up in where you were expected to know math, you would do a lot better at math. So I found that a very interesting paradox.
Indeed, especially because I forgot until you pointed it out in the book that the head of Mattel at the time of the Math is Tough speaking Barbie was a woman. So sound of hand hand slapping head. I have this image of you, Janice, this mental image of you staying up until 2 a.m. Doing research, finding one woman genius after another. Was it like that?
I had a great time doing this book, and I was totally dedicated to it and spent a long time researching it and writing it and trying to figure out what the format should be to put it together so that it was fun to read, because my style is to be fun and to be funny, and I had been the editor of Parade magazine, as you said, so I like reaching a broad audience, and I like making things accessible to people. So it was just a wonderful project to get to dedicate myself to and get to meet all of these wonderful, smart people and start thinking myself in new and different ways.
We have about half a minute left. I want to get to the story of Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier.
Yes, they are the women who actually had one of the great discoveries of our current century, which was the a way to do genetic manipulation, which is called CRISPR. And they have already, they have won many big awards. They've gotten some great attention for it, but they are already being pushed aside and written out of history by the men who have done some things after them, have been able to get the patents, have been able to take control of their story. I saw that 60 Minutes had a story about CRISPR a few months ago where they never even mentioned the women who first discovered it.
Oh, I will say it again then. Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, all mentioned in the book The Genius of Women, and many more as well, by Janice Kaplan, the subtitle From Overlooked to Changing the World, proven again and again. Janice Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. That will do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers are John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time and have a great day.